Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is 89.7 NPR News, and today we're talking about all things internet. And we'll start with the tug of war over who should control and regulate the internet. The Federal Trade Commission has pushed for stronger oversight, but a recent court ruling all but defeated the concept known as net neutrality. Here to walk us through it is Associate Professor Danny Kimball. He chairs the Media Arts and Studies program at Gloucester College in Baltimore. He also wrote the 2022 book, Net Neutrality and the Struggle for the Open Internet. Welcome to All Sides, Danny Kimball.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. So let's start with net neutrality and your best way to explain it in a way that everyone can understand.
Right. Well, it has kind of a reputation as difficult to understand, but I think at its core, it's pretty simple. It's a principle of openness and equality in access to the internet. So basically, as an internet user, you should be able to connect to what you want without your internet access provider like Comcast or AT&T interfering with that. So that's essentially the core principle that there has been a two-decade-long battle about whether and how to put that principle into policy. And so that's sort of the tug of war that you've been referring to, that that this is fighting over. But at a basic level, I think, you know, most people understand that, like, you know, if I want to listen to Amy Jurevich on my phone, I shouldn't have Verizon, my internet provider, on my cell phone, say, no, you can't. Or to say, well, yeah, you can, but it's going to be a really slow buffering stream. And by the way, say something like Joe Rogan or something like that is going to stream very fast, just fine, because maybe he has the money to be able to pay them for preferential treatment. And, you know, public media, nonprofit media can't compete in that sort of pay for play kind of game. So that's the sort of thing that net neutrality policy sought to protect from. Basically, that came to a head in 2015 when the Obama administration passed a set of rules through the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, that's rules that said internet access providers couldn't block or slow down or speed up sites or services or apps or content on the internet, or otherwise kind of give preferential treatment to some things over others. And in passing those rules, they also classified internet access as like an essential utility service. So basically saying, you know, we rely on internet access to live our everyday lives the same way we rely on things like electricity or water or phone service. So being able to treat the internet under that new classification as essential infrastructure, basically the FCC was saying, you know, this is something that everybody needs access to on equal terms.
Yeah, so the FCC is saying, it said that, and those are the 2015 rules you're referring to, right?
That's right.
Are those still in effect now 10 years later?
Yeah, so that is the latest update to this. So
right.
there was a volley back and forth where those rules that were passed under Obama were repealed under Trump. And then the Biden administration attempted to bring them back. And this latest court ruling, Ohio Telecom v. FCC, which was just decided in the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, basically they said, no, the FCC can't bring back those rules. So those rules are no longer in place. And I think the upshot of that is that what we should be able to count on as some basic protections are gone now. And that leaves us vulnerable to the telecom industry, to big cable companies and phone companies that control our access to the internet, for them to do basically whatever is most profitable for them, without what's in the people's interest and the public interest, without those sort of regulatory protections there.
Now, obviously, this is all about money because it's always about money. So the big telecom companies want to be able to make money. They want to charge more for faster internet, right? And they want people to pay for the better service. So basically, this court ruling said that the FCC lacks the authority to oversee wireless and broadband service. They can't regulate it. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it basically limits their ability to regulate it to basically the by them saying this is a kind of essential public utility, they're saying that the internet is more like a phone service that everybody should be able to connect to than something like cable TV, which they have some say over, but it's not like a regulator's sort of say, like this is an essential thing everybody needs. So the court, on kind of technical reasons, went in and said, well, the internet functions in this way that makes it less like a telephone service. And so that means that, which is one of the core sort of jurisdictions of the FCC, they said, no, the FCC can't have these rules that treat it like phone service or like a utility service. And so it really limited their ability to not just protect net neutrality, but also do things like what you're understand you're talking about later in the show about ensuring access to the internet, whether it's making it more affordable for people, low income people who can't afford internet access, or rural areas that don't have access, protections for privacy, assurances for public safety networks, a lot of important work that the FCC was able to do when the internet was able to be treated as a public utility, that this essentially strips the agency of the ability to do that kind of work too.
So this idea of net neutrality keeps ping-ponging back and forth. You mentioned, there were rules in 2015. Trump pulled them back, and then Biden tried to put them back in, and now, here we are. Is it going to keep ping-ponging, or do you think it's going to stall right now?
Well, I think in a certain way, this ends the battle over FCC rules. So this basically says that the FCC regulating net neutrality rules is basically not going to go anywhere now. The ideal way for this to proceed would be for Congress to just make a law that protects this, and then that would stay in place regardless of who's in the White House, which of course gives them control over, who they appoint to head federal agencies, and that's where this sort of ping pong comes from. If Congress passed a law, this could just be protected and put in place. I think that's not, to put it lightly, that is very not likely. Not just because of Republican control of Congress right now, but just the way that Congress functions, or rather doesn't function, makes that really unlikely that we're going to see any sort of net neutrality legislation. I think one way that the kind of I would say a tenuous status quo of net neutrality staying sort of mostly kind of mostly in place is actually a silver lining of this court ruling, that it does not touch state level laws. And there's actually a number of state governments that have passed their own net neutrality rules, most significantly California, which is of course important nationally, not just in general, but to the internet in particular, as home of Silicon Valley. Net neutrality rules in place in California basically gives broadband providers incentives to pretty much stick to that nationwide, especially nationwide networks like cell phone providers, whereas cable companies tend to be more regional. The laws may not apply to them, but with California protecting it, it provides some sort of incentive for there to be a kind of tenuous protection for net neutrality to sort of keep them on their best behavior, or at least not their worst behavior.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the present and future of internet access with Associate Professor Danny Kimball from Gloucester College. He wrote the book Net Neutrality and the Struggle for Open Internet. So let's get back to that idea of whether the internet should be a utility or not. I'm not very up on my when electricity became needed to be like when did electricity or having water or sewer, I don't know what years that became standard where everyone has to have access to it. But are we just not there yet with the internet?
I think it's a great question. I think in if you talk to the average person about, you know, whether they consider access to the internet sort of essential to their everyday lives, I imagine you would find close to 100% agreement in that. And not just for those that do have access to it, but that is certainly felt by those that don't have access to it. And that sort of inclusion in everyday society to do basic things for your job, for your education, for, you know, navigating your social life. That's to try to do that without the ability to connect to the internet, or to do it without you know, sort of reliable, fast connection to the internet, you know, that's close to impossible. And in that way, I think, you know, the general public consensus is that, yeah, this is an essential service that should be treated as a utility. And it's more so part of a very common kind of mismatch between the needs of everyday people and the experience of everyday people and the laws and policies and regulations that that we have in place to protect those things, and is instead part of the problem with, you know, the way our policy is done, and not any sort of like, you know, the internet hasn't yet reached some essential status.
Yeah. And back to the idea of it going state by state. I mean, we in this country seem to like to do a lot of things state by state. So each state is different in what how much urban and rural area they have. So each state would have to come up with an incentive for certain companies to be able to bring the right wires or you know, poles, or, you know, even just putting up the right infrastructure to bring technology, to bring the internet to rural areas. Are you seeing states wanting to spend the money on that?
I think it's something that there has been a push sort of from federal government funding to that has the idea was that it would kind of be passed on to the states, and states would then not sort of be left on their own to try to invest in that infrastructure just on their own. But I think it hasn't quite worked out in practice the way that it was envisioned. And I think that's part of why we see still huge gaps in the not just access, but quality of access for a lot of people. And it's something that I think does disproportionately affect rural areas, where without that government funding and without the sort of idea of, you know, this is a public resource all people should have, then the decisions are just made by companies who decide, well, is it profitable for us to build out to these areas where fewer people live and less density? And it just left up to the profit motive instead of, you know, sort of ideas of like essential public services. That, you know, if we can't treat the internet like a utility in that way, then it is just left up to, well, what is going to be most profitable for these private companies that control that infrastructure.
Well, and then there's the idea of if one company decides I'm going to bring my internet to this neighborhood or this area, then they have a monopoly because there's no one else. You know, if Verizon lays the cables or if Comcast lays the cables, or then it's their internet, and people in that area don't have a choice. They have to pay if they want it. They have to pay what, because that company did the legwork, right?
Yeah, I absolutely think that's one of the biggest issues here, is that you know, so much of the approach to this is you know, the sort of policy of, Well, as long as people, it's, a free market and people have choice over, if they don't like their internet service, they can, choose something that's better. And that can't happen if we have monopolies, where you only have a choice between, one or two internet providers in your local area. They don't have any incentive to offer any better service or lower price, and people don't have any choice about, switching from one thing to another. So that kind of monopolization of internet access is part of what also raises concerns about, like, well, if they don't have any sort of check on their power from competition or from regulation because of, these deregulations, then, they're sort of all powerful, and that's part of, sort of broader concerns about monopolies in our economy that is felt in people's, everyday experiences.
The outgoing FCC chairwoman, a Democrat, after the court ruling that we mentioned earlier in the show, she said that consumers still want fast, open, and fair internet. She called on Congress to protect those measures, but we talked about that, where it probably will end up being a dead end. But in her statement, that idea, fast, open, and fair, who gets to decide what's fair? I mean, I guess basically that's what this is all about, right?
Yeah, I think that really is key to this too, that I think there's sort of broad agreement that most people would have that, like, not just that access to the internet is something that should be essential, that we should be able to guarantee to all people, but that access should come with fairness in what you're able to do. Because part of what is special about the internet and how it's sort of changed so much about the way that our access to information and our communication and our media works is that it's something that everyday people aren't just there consuming, but are creating things and sharing things with each other. And if they can't sort of, to use that example again about, like, somebody that isn't some sort of giant corporation or, a huge sort of celebrity figure that could maybe afford to get preferential treatment and pay up to internet providers, that the sort of everyday people who are creators on the internet can't really survive in an environment like that where they'd be, expected to have to, pay up to be able to compete.
That's Danny Kimball. He chairs the Media Arts and Studies program at Goucher College in Baltimore, and he wrote the 2022 book, Net Neutrality and the Struggle for the Open Internet. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about efforts to increase digital literacy to Ohioans. That is when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. In Franklin County, 80,000 households lack affordable, reliable access to home internet. One in three working Americans possesses limited digital skills, and one in six are unable to use email, web search, or other basic online tools. We're talking about all things internet this hour, and how hard it is to live in a technology-advanced universe when you're not digitally literate, or if you can't afford or don't have the necessary tools. Joining us now are two guests who represent organizations who are working to change that. Jordan Davis is the executive director of Smart Columbus, which works with organizations that are a part of the Franklin County Digital Equity Coalition. Welcome to All Sides, Jordan.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us is Evan Garver, the program manager for workforce development programs at Goodwill Industries. Welcome to All Sides, Evan.
Thank you.
So, Jordan, let's start with you about how Smart Columbus is working toward equitable internet access. And
maybe what do you mean by equitable?
Sure. Mm-hmm. So Smart Columbus really exists to help the community prepare for the future. And there's no question the future will be more tech-enabled, and we can't leave people behind in that future. And the truth is, too many of our residents are either don't have access to the internet affordably or in a quality way that can meet their needs, or they don't have the skills and devices necessary to fully utilize the internet to create opportunity for themselves and their family. And so what we're looking at is both ensuring that residents have quality access to internet devices and skills training, but then also have it availability to begin with.
So you're working to, I mean, in Franklin County, it's not that there's a lack of the internet here, not like a rural county.
Correct.
where they physically just don't have the wires and tubes.
Correct.
But in Franklin County, it's more access to be able to afford to bring it to your house. Is that right?
Afford and at a quality that meets their needs. So some affordable plans may be feasible. There's low-income plans that might be $10 a month, mm-hmm. but that bandwidth may only service email. Mm. When what they really need to do is participate in Zoom calls to get a job at a call center that allows them to work from home, or be able to do a telehealth appointment with a doctor. And that simply just, that bandwidth doesn't allow for that. And so what we want is affordable bandwidth that can support a family in a household.
Yeah, so you're not just helping them play video games. You want
That's
them to
right.
be able to use the internet
yes.
for practical and work purposes and health purposes.
Yes, but we're not naive to the fact that well-being is the first gateway to the internet being something they value.
People should right. be allowed to play video games if they want.
That's
right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Okay. So in Franklin County, there's about 80,000 households that lack internet. It's hard to believe that there's that many in such a populous county as well. When you hear that number, do you think, wow, we have a lot of work to do?
Absolutely. We have a lot of work to do. Yeah. And we really think of it as a regional issue as well. We also convene the Central Ohio Regional Digital Inclusion Alliance as part of the state efforts. And we have a lot of even bigger issues just in neighboring counties, whether it's in Delaware County or Licking County, which are big growth counties. But they're experiencing a lot of gaps in their broadband access and availability, but then also skills.
And tell me about so you mentioned that you have a coalition that's Central Ohio, too. And so the mm-hmm. Franklin County Digital Equity Coalition, why decide to form a coalition? Is it just one group can't handle it on their own?
The coalition started on the advent of COVID. And it was really a response to how do we work together to close these gaps? How do we help Columbus City Schools go one-to-one with devices? How do we help the libraries meet the demand for residents who need devices and who need skills training? And so it was a community-wide response to meeting those emergent needs. And as we started convening, we started to realize that we really didn't have much infrastructure in place in this community to strategically and systemically solve this problem. We had a lot of one-off kind of efforts, but mm-hmm. nothing that was really coordinated at scale. And to the numbers that you referenced before, this is a problem at scale. Mm-hmm. And so we need to behave like a system. And so this is really a way that we can bring all the partners who are part of that at the table so that we can think together and strategize together how to close skills gaps, make sure that affordable and high quality devices are accessible to anyone that needs it, and to try to promote continued investment in our infrastructure.
And one of those partners, Evan, I'm going to bring you into the conversation here. You're working on the ground with people to improve what's known as digital life skills, especially when it applies to the workforce. Can you give us an idea of how Goodwill is working toward those digital life skills?
Yeah, as a member of the Digital Equity Coalition, we work very closely with other partners providing these sort of services. So we'll start with our own in-house training abilities. We have job training centers at four different locations around town to help meet folks where they're at in the community. So whether it's downtown, east side, west side, north side, we have job training centers that also include learning labs where we have computers available to folks that want to come in, learn about skills, or apply that to their job search or whether it's other parts of their life that they want to get stronger at. In addition to that, we have grant funding that allows us to partner with the Columbus Metropolitan Libraries to provide free drop-in workshops all around town. We're at 13 different metropolitan libraries where each day We'll have a different focus topic where there's two or three different workshops that are available. Folks can drop in. They can take one. They can take all three or four. Mm-hmm. And they get to build upon those skills that they already have. So maybe one module is around learning about Google applications. Another module is learning around technology and how it helps you get transportation around town. Mm-hmm. We're helping build not only their abilities to seek and find employment, but also those supplemental skills that are needed to be successful in life, like navigating new technologies around cloud software.
Yeah, I can imagine. Do you have people who come to you or come to these workshops and they have their phone and they're like, I need help. I need to learn how to use the Coda app, for example, like the transportation app. Can you help teach me? Is that something you can work on?
Of course. Yeah. We just started doing those sort of workshops at the libraries where we encourage people to bring their own devices, and we can have devices available at the library, whether it's something the library has or we bring our own devices from Goodwill. But really, the strength of the program lies in when folks bring their own devices, because
right.
that's the ones that they're going to be taking home with them.
Right.
And we want them to be strong. We want there to be self reliance on their own skills so that they can make progress on whatever they seek to use those skills for.
Yeah, and Jordan, your organization can bring the high-speed, reliable internet to those 80,000 people, but then if they don't know how to troubleshoot to use it, then what's the point?
That's right. It's a build it and you will come strategy is not what we think is a recipe for success. We need to make sure people are prepared to fully utilize it. And so we've been partnering with Evan and Goodwill and about 15, 16 other organizations to build what we're calling the Digital Skills Hub, which is a scaled training program where we'll train 10,000 residents for at least 10 hours of training for basic digital skills. And then on completion of that training, they'll receive a new device. And we think that just giving a device.
What kind of device?
It's a high-end Chromebook or an iPad, depending on the use case for those individuals. But we really think that just, you know, having access to a device is great, but you really need the skill sets to be able to fully optimize that device. And so we want to equip people with that, too.
Not everyone has access to a 13-year-old to help them, right?
That's right.
That's whenever I don't know how to use something or my parents, you know, that you go younger and younger of who you're
yes.
asking for help now,
right? Yeah, right.
This is All Sides, and we are talking about improving internet access and digital literacy with Jordan Davis, Executive Director of Smart Columbus, and Evan Garver, Program Manager for Workforce Development Programs at Goodwill Industries. So, Evan, you talked about these classes. Are we talking mostly adults? Who are your clientele?
Yeah, for the most part, the population that we serve are adults. For our Digital Skills Hub programs, as well as the workshops that we provide in the libraries, we do have some closed cohorts that we work with other partner providers. So that could be individuals who are in reentry or maybe folks experiencing housing crisis, where we work specifically with those groups, and it's and that partner agency based on those needs. So we know that there's skill sets that are needed for all age groups,
mm-hmm.
right? So, but for the most part, the programs that we operate are designed to help adults get the skills that they need. We find that having classes available during the day, for the most part, and then on select weekends, that allows, you know, that extended time that we need to really get impactful learning in more than just like an hour or hour and a half. Most of our workshops in the library, they're an hour and a half, but we're there for three or four classes. So we could spend a significant amount of time with people. Our Digital Skills Hub program that Jordan referenced, that is 10 hours of training. And we get that done over three or four sessions. So there's a lengthy amount of time. And we find that if there's maybe school age kids, sometimes that can be a distraction, or that's probably a longer time mm-hmm. than what's available. We try to find partners at locations where there might be an option for a childcare opportunity to allow parents with young children to participate more easily. But for the most part, the programs that we offer are designed for adults, and specifically adults from vulnerable populations. They tend to be the ones that need the most help, that have the least amount of access to resources.
And I can imagine that sometimes going into these classes, someone might feel a little embarrassed, you know, like they don't know how to access their email. They know they have an email address, but they can't figure it out. Or can you help with easing them to feel better about coming in there? And you, like, yes, I will help you recover your password.
You know? That's so common. And it shouldn't be something where you're ashamed to not have those skills, because the digital world is changing all the time. You know, a year or two from now, it's going to look radically different. The basic skills that you're going to need to do the most basic things. I talk about this with my classes all the time. My grandmother had a hard time going to concerts because she couldn't figure out how to do digital tickets on her smartphone.
She just wanted that paper ticket.
Exactly. Yeah. Just those little things to have a high quality of life. Need some skills, and with just a little bit of help and guidance from somebody who is knowledgeable on how to make someone not only feel comfortable and welcome, but also can help them practice those skills for a long period of time and provide follow-up opportunities for free whenever they need to continue to reinforce those skills that they learned originally.
See, now I feel compelled to be like, okay, where's your website so that you can figure out when the classes are? But that, can you also just go in person somewhere and ask for like a flyer
Absolutely.
About the classes? So,
yeah. Some of the organizations that may be very accessible for folks, the Columbus Metropolitan Libraries, all of those libraries, they're offering courses. Goodwill, Columbus State, we're partnering with Ohio State, Jewish Family Services, Godman Guild. So we have a whole list of 16 organizations. 7 are implementing right now. All 16 will be implementing by April. But you can go to connectcentralohio.com and get a whole course list and sign up right there for any of the courses offered by any of the partners.
But if you don't have the internet to go to that website,
you can go to a library.
Then go to a library and
That's
ask the
right.
questions. They'll yep. explain it to you. They'll give you a flyer. Can they even sign you up for the class?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And you mentioned earlier, Jordan, I wanted to make sure we talked about this, that you're joining a coalition with other counties, the surrounding counties, because rural counties have a whole different issue to deal with when it comes to the internet. Can you tell me about what you're doing with the other counties?
Yes. You know, in some regards, the problems are not similar. They just have a slightly different variation in a rural context versus an urban context. The rural context, though, is very much struggling with availability, where they don't have internet actually into the home. And so there is federal funds going through the state of Ohio through the BEAD program that will start to build out infrastructure throughout the state of Ohio, including the central Ohio counties where there's unserved areas. We think that will be a tremendous game changer for the region. But when it comes to skills, it comes to trust, it comes to device access, the issues really are the same. And so we're trying to build models in Franklin County that can scale across the state, but also across central Ohio, so that we can start to learn from each other and share resources.
Other counties can do the library program.
That's
correct. And you can share your resources on how you did the classes and that kind of
Everything
thing.
Everything we're doing is open source that can be plug and played in any context.
Great. And finally, I just wanted to ask about state funding. You mentioned that the state is helping with the funding, but I'm sure that they could go faster or give more money. If you were talking to a state lawmaker right now, what would you say the need is when it comes to money to make this happen?
I think there is a lot of capacity building that needs to be done in our health and human services and nonprofit sector to meet residents where they are. As much as technology is can be done independently, it really takes another person on the other side that can sit with you, give you coaching, help you. And so we really promote continuing to invest in our nonprofits to make sure there's that digital navigation support. So when residents need help, they have someone that can coach them through it.
And what would you say from a Goodwill Industries perspective? Are your classes all full? Do you need more people? Do you need more classes? Is it becoming something that is going to be a strain?
Well, of course, we would love to serve more people. At this time, there's plenty of room for us to continue to serve more. You know, we see that there is funding to continue to support these types of programs, but we're always here to serve and serve folks in a variety of different needs. You know, our subject matter expertise at Goodwill typically revolves around serving people with disabilities, mm-hmm. and we know how to do that. But in general, as for the coalition, we seek to serve all. We find each of our different partners that are a part of this coalition have their own niche of communities or particular populations that they serve the best. So our combined powers together allows us to serve the entire community.
All right. So take your phone with you, sign up for a class, and Evan and his team will help you download the app you need, right?
Mm-hmm. Of course.
All right. Well, coming up, we are going to be talking about a local power collective that is working to bridge the divide in rural communities. But first, I want to say thank you to Jordan Davis, Executive Director of Smart Columbus. Thanks for being here, Jordan.
Thank you for having me.
And Evan Garver, Program Manager of Workforce Development Programs at Goodwill Industries. Thanks for being here, Evan.
Thank you.
And All Sides will continue. This is 89.7 NPR News.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking this hour about all things internet. A 2023 analysis of Broadband Ohio's data found that a majority of Ohio counties, less than half of the populated areas, had broadband access. And the discrepancy between rural and urban areas is stark. For example, 98% of households in Franklin County are connected to broadband, but just 12% of the households in Monroe County, which is on the eastern edge of the state, can say the same. Since this summer, the South Central Power Company has been working to bridge the divide in rural areas. Joining us now is Rick Lemons, president and CEO of South Central Power Company. Welcome to All Sides, Rick.
No, good morning. Thank you.
So your company received $100 million in a state grant to connect parts of its service territory to Appalachia, and it's a 30-month rollout. So can you tell us about how that's going?
I'd love to. Thanks. Well, South Central Power, just in terms of your prior guests, we were formed as a cooperative in the 1930s to bring electricity to rural areas, and we felt very well positioned to be able to have the same sort of rollout for our members on the internet. We've been involved in providing internet to our members really for almost 20 years. It began back where we offered a satellite option to our members, and for a variety of reasons that hasn't panned out and didn't pan out. But as you mentioned, we've been on quite a journey these past 5 years and started our rollout in September. The construction of our project in September of 2023.
So it is $100 million. Does that grant pay for increasing your workforce, or is it paying for actual, like, building things?
Sure. That's a very good question. So the grant, the story on the grant for us was we began our, if you will, our assessment really 5 years ago. And that was about the same time that the governors created the Broadband Ohio office. And it was the fall of 2021 that Broadband Ohio first offered a program where we could offset the cost of construction of a high-speed, high-quality internet for our rural members. And the rough estimate of $100 million of grant funds covers about half the cost of the construction of the network. And I think primarily that is what the funds are being used for, to construct the network. And the expectation is then that our monthly charge for the service will pay for the customer service, the member service, the ongoing maintenance activities related to our projects.
So basically, you're building and you're becoming an internet company too.
That's
in
right.
addition to an electricity company.
That's exactly right. And as you mentioned earlier, we are cooperative and we are governed by those that we serve. And we feel very strongly. One of your, the professor was talking about the monopoly process, and we recognize that when we extend fiber optic internet into the living room, not just the mailbox, but directly into the living room, and really transform or change the way that these residents have used and have thought about. How they can use high-speed internet, and we recognize that we are a monopoly, and we're very proud of the fact that we operate on a not-for-profit basis, and without the state's help, we would not have been able to bring this level of service and this quality of service to these members in these two projects.
So the state's money is helping you be able to get the internet to these people and then be able to give it to them at an affordable price instead of charging them hundreds of dollars a month.
That's right. We offer two speeds today, Amy. We offer gig service for about $110 a month, and we offer a 500 symmetrical speeds, 500 megabits, for about $85 a month.
Okay. And are you building wires underground, or are we talking about using your existing electricity poles?
Substantially, our project substantially is using the existing pole line infrastructure. Mm. Where we have buried our electric facilities, we will also bury the fiber cable.
Is that the goal eventually, to bury it all instead of having it up in the air, or does it depend on place to place? Is it different each place?
It would be the cost delta, the difference in the cost between burying and attaching it to our existing infrastructure is significant.
Mm-hmm.
And so in our case, in terms of the overall feasibility, it's much more cost effective to install it on the existing infrastructure.
This is All Sides, and we're talking with Rick Lemons, president and CEO of South Central Power Company, and we're talking about his company's work to bring high-speed internet to rural parts of Ohio. So it's basically some of the areas you serve are so rural that you're going house to house. It's not like you're feeding a neighborhood of people, right?
That's right. The density, if you will, it ranges from 4 consumers per mile to about 6. And that is why the cost and really the availability is so limited. And we would not be able to offer the level of service at the price point that we're at without the state's assistance.
And your service area covers about 24 counties. So we're talking, give me an idea. This is southern, central, and eastern Ohio. What right. are some of the counties that you're covering? You don't have to list all 24.
Well, okay, great, because I don't think I could. The internet project is really two distinct areas of the state. The first is what we refer to the West, and that is really using the city of Hillsborough and Highland County as the hub, and then the areas just outside of Highland County, Fayette County, Ross, Pike, a little bit of Adams. That is what we refer to as our West our West project. The Eastern project, which you mentioned one of the counties earlier, is primarily Belmont, Monroe, and Harrison counties. And we provide electricity over a much greater area, including just south of Columbus here, and But those are the, you know, those are about, there's about 12 counties that are affected with the broadband project.
And earlier you mentioned that you offer two different internet speeds. If people get the lower level speed that you, I think you said it was $85 a month, can they still do things like have a Zoom call if they work, if they need to work from home, or a telehealth appointment?
Yes. We were very intentional to make sure that we offered packages for that we expected any rural consumer would be able to do the things that you mentioned, do their education online, do the gaming, if you will. But also from a value proposition, we wanted levels of service so that these consumers, if they decided, they could get rid of their satellite television. And in many cases, what we're doing here is we are, as your previous guests were talking, we are trying to help our members better understand that there is a tremendous value here in using an $85 broadband to eliminate the satellite television and some of the other products to the point where we believe that most members can save $100 to $150 a month by taking even our $500 up and down package.
Right. So you're giving them access to all the streaming services they couldn't have before, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And as Ryan and Jordan were talking, we're also out in the communities helping members better use the technology, better use the service, so that, again, they can stay in touch, not just stay in touch with children and grandchildren, but also telemedicine and all of these other things, including remote work and remote education and all of those other advantages that these consumers have that are connected to our network.
Now, let me ask you a question about competition, because there's other companies making similar pushes. Spectrum announced a $1.25 billion speed-up service to speed up their work for getting the internet out there. In your areas, though, you have they're your electric poles, right? So if Spectrum comes a knocking and says, we want to attach to your poles, would you say no?
No, we would not. And in fact, our goal here is whether it's South Central Power and its division Connect SCP or Spectrum or Frontier, it really does not matter to us. We will do what we can to encourage really the development and the extension of high-speed quality, high-speed internet to all of our members.
Now, you mentioned that your company dates back to the 30s when a group of farmers came together to bring electricity to rural communities. Do you see a lot of parallels? Are we in our new, like, the 2030s are the new 1930s, where it's like you brought electricity to everyone, now you're going to bring the internet to everyone?
Well, that is one of the messages that we have been talking with our board and with our members about, that we have done what we think to be a very good job in providing electric service in these 24 counties. And we feel that, as we grow and retain the right talent, that we're gonna be able to do that with our fiber internet customers as well.
And we're down to just a little over a minute, but I wanted to ask you about the idea we talked about in the first segment about whether the internet is a utility or not. I mean, you're a utility man, electricity. Is the internet a utility?
Well, the word utility does have legal references. It's certainly, we are, we whether we talk about electric or fiber, we refer to this as a service. Mm-hmm. And I can certainly understand and appreciate the challenges that the incumbents have. There are incumbent telecommunications companies that have been really we've been serving side by side with them, but we also know the density. And when you only have four or five, maybe six consumers per mile, the cost of really any upgrade becomes substantial, and the ability for a company different from South Central, that their profitability factors, their payback information, their cost benefit information, their rates of return are much different than ours as we operate as a cooperative on a not-for-profit basis.
I want to thank you for your time today. That's Rick Lemons, President and CEO of South Central Power Company. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. This has been All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News.